I did find a copy of a poem that I was asked to read, so I'm pleased to do that. It's called Quatrains for a Christmas Bear. It's from a book called The Burning World, which is Homestead, basically. And this was over a Christmas a decade or more ago by now, in which a black bear had been seen a number of times on the north side of the Monongahela River, and which alarmed me because I feared what they would do if they got a hold of it. But somehow it made its escape and was seen last above Dravosburg, heading back to whence it came, which I thought was a good thing. And then that sort of went to the side, and I worried about getting my kids to school and this and that and the other thing. And then a couple weeks later, I found I was still thinking about it. And at that point, I thought that it was insisting itself in a way that that sometimes poems do, where they seem to say, I'm not going to be ignored, pay attention, wake up, you know, hey, sleepy. So it's in two sections. Quatrains for a Christmas Bear. Black and massive as an upturned stump, it rummaged among us this December, ravenous for rinds and the sour mash in trash cans set out in city yards, and managed to sleep it off unnoticed in whatever covert it found, a quarter ton of slumbering earth, alert to the faintest of sounds. It must have come up through the woods from Duck Hollow and the Monongahela, following the clear spore of winter stars to where they grow tangled and lost within the general heaven of arc lamps and headlights on passing cars. 3 days and nights, like a story or the passage of a tragic god. Nearing the solstice, it was seen once more, dogged by wardens and the competing cameras from the evening news, but now on the far shore of the river, hunched and coaly as the foothills rising beyond the old mill towns. And whether because the wilderness brushed against us like a scent, or because my own loneliness was salved, I like to imagine its slow withdrawal, ambling in shadow across an empty bridge, or swimming that distance, snout lifted above the iron cold chop of those waters, breath on the air. A bear, the color of the winter night, companions above it, constellated there. Thank you. And the next poems I'll read are all from a new book called Sheet Music. Sheet Music was an attempt after three books of writing about Pittsburgh in its industrial historical sense and setting, and my relationship to that, was an attempt, or is an attempt, to fill out other aspects of growing up here. So there's a lot of poems in here about museums and more cultural and other sort of sightings. And also, I guess my family as well. The first poem in the book is called Kites, and it's I had an editor years and years and years ago. I said, I really like your poems, but boy, he said, your titles are really terrible. You know, can't you punch up your titles somewhat? And I said, I don't know if I could, I would. So Kites is about kites. So he seemed to think that was not a good, that was a little lame. But anyway, so anyway, it's called Kites. Come March, we'd find them in the five and dimes, furled tighter than umbrellas about their slats. The air in an undertow above us, like weather on the maps. We'd play out lines of kite string, tugging against the bucking sideways flights. Readied for assembly, I'd arc the tensed keel of balsa into place against the crosspiece, feeling the paper snap tautly as a sheet, then lift the almost weightless body up to where it hauled me, trolling into the winds. Knotted bows like vertebrae flashing among fields of light. Why ruin it by recalling the aftermath? Kites gone down in tatters, kites fraying like flotsam from the tops of the trees. This is a prefatory poem called The Music Lesson. It's for my son, Matthew, who was started off on the violin and then years later migrated to the double bass. And when he became a very good bass player, I asked him why he started with the violin. What was the attraction to begin with? And he said it seemed to him an easier instrument to play than a woodwind. It didn't take all the effort of blowing through a reed. So sometimes the path of least resistance, you know, isn't a bad path after all. Having just unpacked that violin, the color of casked brandy, and set it upright before him, my son starts reciting the names of the parts he is learning, pointing each one out to his mother as if tracing a splendid anatomy. Neck, fingerboard, bridge, the shaped grain gleaming like parquetry there by the parlor window where the words fall like light. Body, peg box, scroll, the taut strings plinking one by one as he fingers them in an off-key pizzicato and goes on with the naming, chin rest and tailpiece, the hours on their way towards him, the bow he'll soon be using to kindle music from the chambered wood. This is another music poem. It's called Spirit in the Dark, which is also the name of a great Aretha Franklin gospel album, although this doesn't have anything to do with Aretha Franklin. Or gospel maybe, but not Aretha Franklin. And it also has to do with a visitation of what at the other end of Pennsylvania they call poltergeists or prankster ghosts or a kind of minor spirit that shows up at times, especially in old houses. And this is a poem that sort of asks, is trying to come to terms of what does an experience like that mean? It should be profound, right? I mean, something comes from another dimension. So why would that not be? Why would that be something that just sort of slips back into, you know, the woodwork or wherever it goes back to? And I think it also asks, what's the experience of our relationship to great music or great art, too? I mean, shouldn't that have the same kind of registration, right? Rilke says, you must change your life, right, when you look at the statue. Well, we don't, mostly. Or in ways, maybe, that we don't know. So, poem's called Spirit in the Dark. What to make of the night we sat up late, listening to Beethoven's Ninth in that otherwise darkened apartment? The New York Philharmonic was gathering together the fragments at the fourth movement's start. Momentum, they'd ride like a wave through the fanfare and final chorus, when we felt something else enter the air, a front in the weather of the room. It set us upright on the edge of our chairs while it tracked toward the record and hung suspended for a measure or two above the still point of the stylus. Then, just as steadily, it withdrew, a patch of fog that had been burned off. The look the dead raised on your face must have been the same on my own. What was that? Our expressions asked. Decades later, I'd still like to know, and what changes, if any, were played upon us, and did any of them take? Be embraced, the chorus sang, and then the crescendo and kettle drums, the whole ninth welling before us, before fading as well from the room. This is a poem called Soloing, and it's from the section, the title section, sheet metal of the book. And the first sentence is spoken in the poem by the he that becomes clear that this is a poem about somebody else, and it's what's called indirect discourse, if you want an academic I try to avoid reference. And it's about a night I was sitting with a friend of mine. We were listening to some of his jazz records, and he had just come through a fairly shattering divorce that he was starting to talk about. That was a bad time, let me tell you. I was taking Valium, and there were lawnmowers everywhere. There's a vision of hell, right? Lawnmowers everywhere. We'd been listening to Chet Baker and early Brubeck, those red, see-through fantasy LPs in which the notes seemed pressed in pectin. My friend said it took him by surprise, meaning the divorce, his wife having taken up with what he called the brown rice and cocaine crowd, leaving him to muddle as best he could into his own ritual sense of separation. For her was a kind of makeover, new clothes and furniture, and redecorating every corner of the room. That was when she taunted him, "Now I won't have to listen anymore to that horrible music of yours." You wonder why people get divorced. And packing his records, it occurred to him he'd never argue with her again. So there was that, at least, to build on. And the boast that she'd been voting Republican all along. And the frilly heart-shaped pillow she'd just bought for her nightstand. In the meantime, he told me, he'd have to bear the memory of those afternoons they first made love after work. The plum tree blooming in the window, late sun upon them as she'd start to quake, and that trumpet aching from the other room. Okay, I wanted to finish up with two house poems or residence poems. We were living in Ohio for a couple years, and I was driving down to Pittsburgh and came down the Ohio River Boulevard, where some of my relatives lived. And I looked up the street, and I saw my cousin in front of the house he grew up in, trimming the privet hedge. I thought, oh my God, you know, he's back. So anyway, my cousin, who had grown up in Emsworth, had moved back to Emsworth, and I thought, what is a life like where you? Because my life has been so much trying to get back to something, and here was somebody that actually did. And I thought, was that altogether a good thing? And what? How does that play out? And what's it like to be in the same? You know, you're in your 60s, and you're in the room where, you know, where you were six, and the same trees outside the window. And is that? You know, what does that do for you? Is that a real terrific, because now I'm home and I'd never, oh no, so, or is it somehow back to something that you can't get, you know, wolf, you know, can't get back to home? So I thought I'd think it out in a poem. So the poem's called The Prodigal's Version of Emsworth. He's the speaker, my cousin. Alone in bed in mother's house, waiting for sleep, I watch that tree in my window gleam with the same cold fire of starlight I dreamt of entering as a boy, scrambling down the branches. Beyond it, the arbor, the alley lined with fences, and those garages like tenement flats are all still the same as well, though divorced at 60 and home for good. My life feels like something I've remembered from a dream. Here for the holidays, my wife sleeping quietly beside me, I'd feel the familiar weight of darkness take my shape, that scent like thyme in my nostrils. Some of those nights, lying awake, I'd finally descend the stairs to stand in the shadowy rooms, my eyes filling with whatever light came spilling through the blinds, though even in the dark I knew the whereabouts of each thing there, the way I could see my life, wife, children, the Connecticut house. Here this morning, I trimmed the hedge my father planted, shearing its box shape out of the tangle it had lapsed into. I weeded mother's tomatoes, the patch I've dug in the corner of the yard that catches most of the afternoon sun. I thought a man lay down each night and rose each morning, and his life lay there before him, clear as water in a bowl. You could sink your hands into it. You could cup it upwards to your face, and what poured through your fingers was spill off and plenty, like grace. Tonight after supper, mother and I sat out back in that strange amber light you sometimes find before a storm. The sky gone gray above us, the air tropic and saturate, in the nap of the lawn. listening for the familiar sound of rain in the trees. It struck me just how readily the familiar can change into something strange. And I thought out loud, just how can that be? And the opposite experience of that is seeing, for some reason, serendipity, or Jung would have a good term for it, an ad in the paper for the sale of a house that I grew up in Homestead. And not only that, but by Toth, if you know German, death, Toth Realtors. I mean, come on. estate of Joanne Carr to Toth Holdings, Incorporated, 326 East 16th Avenue, $20,000, Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. The poem's called Crusoe and Crusoe, like in, you know, his nibs. Crusoe and Homestead. And I was teaching Crusoe in English class at that time, and irritated by him. All week I've been railing against Crusoe, for whom home was a ghostly geography, more real than his own. His cave a cellar, mortar a tortoise shell. And now, here's mine in the real estate listings. How many closings since we sold it the summer I turned 4. What's exile anyway, but one of the forms of longing? And what's a more permanent address? When I came to England, he tells us, I was as perfect a stranger to all the world as if I had never been known there. And in that England on 16th Avenue, where not even the cellar in which I once locked my stepmother is a treasure of hoarded time, what would I be looking to get back to or find but a house as dull as the clouds, the late centuries worth of weather it seems to be wearing whenever I happen to buy. Nor inside, where most of my memories are hand-me-downs, am I likely to recognize a thing, not the honeycombed gas grates or panes of glass rippling within their frames. The bedroom in which my mother died, the parlor where my grandfather lay in state after dying in the mills, would only mirror the light alone, as if I had never been known there. And Crusoe, near the end of his adventures, isolate and growing old, he's haunted as always with the possible, for whom departure is still the only home. Thank you.